Bat Segundo here. The essayist David Rakoff is a man after my own heart. For he, like me, is convinced that he's a fraud. Even though he offered our young roving correspondent cookies, and even though he welcomed our young roving correspondent into his apartment with kindness and good grace. So unless the cookies and the apartment were not real, I don't see how any of this was fraudulent. Perhaps he poisoned the cookies, which may explain in part why our young roving correspondent hasn't been returning my calls of late. On second thought, it does seem curious that Rakoff and our young roving correspondent would meet on the day after Thanksgiving for this interview. Maybe he was borrowing another gentleman's apartment and pretending to live there. Whatever the case, I'll let you be the judge.
Okay, so I'm here with David Rakoff, who is the author of Fraud and Don't Get Too Comfortable. David, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. We're here the day after Thanksgiving, and
yes,
I have to maybe sort of ask you, you write in Fraud about how you like to be indoors, and yet there's also a couple of travel pieces that you do. I'm wondering if it takes a writing assignment for you to escape your interior environment, or what causes this?
It essentially takes a writing assignment for me to do anything, really. And it's not, I don't mean that in the Naomi Campbell, I won't wake up for less than $5,000 a day thing. I mean it in terms of a general kind of free-floating anxiety and a kind of polymathically phobic way of being in the world. Mm-hmm. So almost everything, I mean, it's been my great good privilege that everything has been kind of a counterphobic exercise, and magazine editors or book editors or whatever who very kindly give me the work is almost the only way that I would ever do anything, because otherwise I would be disinclined or scared. And I'm not being glib when I say that. I'm really pretty well still scared of most things. Although, you know, I moved to New York when I was 17 and that seemed to work out okay. But yeah, it does sort of take outside influence to get me out of the apartment.
Hmm. You write, I have a cookie in my mouth.
It's a good cookie,
it's
right?
It's a good cookie, yes. And I think it's the first cookie I've been in my mouth when I've done these interviews. So
oh, very good.
Thank you very much. But you write that writing is like pulling teeth from your dick. And I want to ask you about this because, not literally, but also primarily because, is it really a matter of having a deadline in place? Isn't writing nothing more than just basically sitting on your ass and actually meeting a deadline and banging something out?
Yeah, I'm much better with deadlines. Mm-hmm. My hat is off to, you know, novelists who work in solitude and manage to produce great work without that kind of whip crack. I really respond well and almost solitarily to deadlines.
Can you not exist without these deadlines, essentially? Or
you know, it's hard for me to say. There must be... This is the thing that's sort of been cognitively interesting to me lately. And I don't know why it suddenly has entered my mind. But when you anticipate something, a place you're about to go or someone you're about to meet or an experience you're about to have that you haven't had before, you haven't seen or you haven't been to, your mind's eye creates an imaginary hypothetical as to what it might be like. And the instant, at least for me, and I think for most people, the instant you come up to the reality of it, that previous hypothetical imagery is gone, mm-hmm. Which I find fascinating, is you cannot for the life of you remember what it was going to be like or what you thought it was going to be like. Similarly, I wasn't immediately paid to be a writer. You know, I had to, like every writer in existence, have to obviously write just for myself until such time as it started to pay and people started to read or whatever. I cannot remember what that time was like. I mean, I remember vaguely emotionally being unhappy in my day job in publishing, and I didn't like my 20s, and my 30s, things sort of started to improve, and now I'm, you know, in my early mid-40s. Ugh. And that's interesting to say that. But so clearly there was a time when I was writing for myself, and not for deadlines, and not for editors, and not for money. And I must have done it, but I can't really remember, which is a little upsetting, considering that a writer's life is about remembering stuff and documenting it, and as true a way as possible, but sadly it just doesn't come to mind.
Then where does the motivation come from to write a new essay for or a new collection? Is it really a matter of just having a deadline now, or where do you find the hunger in writing that you once had?
The hunger is in not coasting and not resting on one's laurels and not trying to continue to have something to say and have an interesting life in that way. You know, to keep thinking about stuff, to try and maintain some notion and climate of rigor in one's life. So it's not entirely about deadlines, and it's not entirely or even fractionally about a desire to be out in the public eye. It's about producing. It's about wanting to produce stuff. It's about wanting longevity and that kind of exercise, in a way.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me very much of the Martha Stewart essay in Don't Get Too Comfortable, in which you say that you have to make things on a daily basis. I was going to ask you, because I don't see any sort of large piles of doodads.
No, I've cleaned up for you. But for example, this table surface and those spools that are now at the coffee tables, those baskets in the corner, that lamp, actually every lamp in here I made, aside from the Noguchi one, which you can sort of tell because it's the most beautiful lamp in the whole damn apartment. But, you know, that kind of desire to make stuff, that's different from writing. I find writing so much more difficult, and I'll do almost anything but write. Whereas making stuff, for want of a better term, crafting, is just really a natural desire to see something and want to turn it into something else.
Do you see performing or doing a piece for This American Life as a way of making something? And also, this kind of leads into another question I wanted to ask you about writing for the voice or for the ear as opposed to writing for the eyes.
Well, doing stuff for This American Life is an interesting hybrid, because you write, obviously, and that's solitary, and then you get to perform it, so that's collaborative. You get to be in a studio with other folks who are producing the piece. It's work that involves other people during the day, which is nice, which is closer to the performing stuff, which I get to do occasionally. And it's also a hybrid because, and I've said this before many times, writing for the voice and writing for the page for me is only, it's a difference of degree, not kind. In that, I mean, it's like when the way I speak and the way I write are very similar. I do speak and write in the same kind of schoolmarmish, dense, kind of effete manner. It's not like it's not like Jim Nabors, who sounded like he sounded when he opened his mouth to sing, was this, you know, bizarrely counterintuitive basso profundo. I don't know if you're old enough to remember Jim Nabors.
I'm actually not old enough, but I have actually gone.
You've seen him, and yes, you've seen him sing, and it's just so weird. You know, where the hell did that come from? It's not like that. They're not dissimilar things, but the way it works on the radio, and I've said this before, one is you're leading people along a string in the dark when you're talking to them on the radio. You can only, if you let go of the string, they are lost to you. You know, they're off into some tunnel or something like that. So things have to be leaner and less discursive, and you've got to kind of stick to the story. When you're writing on the page, you can be a lot more boring. In that, I mean, you can go off on tangents. You're presenting them with a set of plans. It's like you've opened up an entire map, and you can point to Finland, even though you're looking at Senegal, and it's not like Senegal disappears. You know, you just say, oh, there's Finland. So it's that kind of thing. It's different. So when I write something for the radio, I write it the way I want to write it anyway, knowing full well that it's going to, all the extraneous stuff that I would use for a print version and that I might use one day for a print version is going to be cut out. But that just helps me in terms of the thinking of things. Does that make sense?
No, it does. In fact, I wanted to bring up in this disparity in relation to one of your essays in Fraud, I'll take the low road. I observed two Rakoffs here. One is this literary Rakoff that we're talking about. In fact, it actually opens the first two sections. Once the first two sections, you have the first section involving this sense, and pardon my lengthy question here, but I think it will give you a sense of what we're talking about, which is the very unshaven young priest from, I can't read my writing, from Haley on the train up to northern Scotland has the handsome, tormented look of a defrocked cleric from a De Sica neorealist flick. So this is very something that I actually am mangling right now as I speak to it, but it also, when I read this, it strikes out and it's a very punchy sort of sentence. And then in the next section, the second section, you have the following opening sentence. A dog's head is far heavier and generates a great deal more heat than you might imagine. Now that comes off the tip of the tongue like that, but they're both in this particular essay, and it makes me wonder about this possible schizophrenic impulse in you as a writer and as a performer. How do you commingle these two things? And also, while I'm also throwing a whole bunch of stuff at you, an essay like Lush Life, I noticed that it had not appeared anywhere else, and there's actually two other essays that had not appeared anywhere else. So I'm wondering if there's some sort of middle ground between something that is spoken and something that is written that you sometimes speak to, or?
Well, let's see. Well, a lot of the things, certainly in the second book, much of the second book was written only for the book, didn't exist anywhere else. Some of the stuff, I think a good third of Fraud, a third to half of Fraud, was written specifically for the book as well. But in terms of the sort of, when you say the thing about, it's funny, I hadn't heard any of that stuff for the longest time. I haven't, certainly haven't opened the book in years. When you talk about the defrocked De Sica priest reference versus the dog's head priest, are you saying that one is very easy to read and say, and the other one is somewhat less so? Is that what you mean?
One has a certain, I mean, I'm not saying that it's bad. I'm saying that it does clutter the tongue as I was as I was speaking. One comes very naturally and very declarative. I'm wondering about this impulse to sort of, I have many other questions in relation to this, but I want to at least get to the generalities of this disparity between something that is more Baroque, whereas something that is more sort of declarative.
I see. Well, the thing about Baroque language, or that kind of thing, I like words. I don't, you know, and this speaks to almost, sadly, every aspect of my life in that, you know, there's an old power play trick where apparently if you're the silent one, the other person fills the void with blather and then gives everything away. I've never been able to be the strong silent one. And much to my peril and misfortune, I'm invariably the one who fills the void with blather. But that said, I like words. I like language. I just think it's more interesting to know more words and to have more words at one's disposal. And I often get a bit of a shellacking for what is perceived to be this vocabulary that I have. My vocabulary is not that great. You know, there are words that I simply do not know, although I look them up 5-10 times a month, and they will not penetrate my brain. Vitiate, cupidity. I've looked those words up more times than you can possibly imagine. I don't know what they mean. And it strikes me as being this thing about vocabulary as being essentially, I'm extending it to its insane conclusion, but it seems like a vaguely sort of Reagan Republican response, the kind of demonizing of education and equating it with elitism, when in fact it's the very opposite. It's that kind of old style populist progressive, you know, the ticket out for people in a meritocracy, the way in which you might not have to spend the rest of your life in a factory, or your kids could go to college and you can get a better life. You know, it's that kind of thing. But, you know, Reagan and Atwater and their ilk have made it seem like that it's actually an exclusionary tool when it's the opposite. So that said, I like language. I like talking. I like dense sentences. Sometimes the folks at This American Life will have to temper that impulse of mine to say things that are too dense and too difficult to say. But that said, I also understand my own rhythms. So I can say that sentence about the De Sica priest, I'm sure. I haven't read it in years. And, you know, if I'd have to probably read it over once before I did so publicly. But that's just the way I speak. I do enjoy it. I like more notes on the piano than fewer notes on the piano. I can't help it.
With that notion in mind, I wanted to actually ask you about the fact that you tend to have a lot of adjectives in your sentence,
too many,
as opposed to, you know, one noun. And I'm trying to find the specific sentence I wanted to read. Oh yeah, here we go. Here's an example from Tokyo's story. He began that unmistakable wet mouth, lip sucking, compulsive swallowing that indicates the impending need to vomit. Now this is very interesting to me because you could have said he smacked his lips or and evoked smacking his lips, but you actually eschew the verb here. And so I wanted to ask you about...
Oh, wait, go back and say that again?
Yeah, well, I will. He began that unmistakable wet-mouthed, lip-smacking, compulsive swallowing that indicates the impending need to vomit. You want to compile all this information in one sentence when I'm looking at this, and you could have said smack lips or something involving verbs, but you actually went for the more noun or actually more the adjective approach to get to that comparison. So.
Well, because I guess that in this particular case, the lip smacking modifies the swallowing. It's a specific kind of swallowing. You know, the components of grammar are largely unknown to me in a formal sense. I couldn't tell you what like a clause is, and I do not know whom versus who for the life of me. So I try to avoid it. But yeah, doesn't it? I mean, but you know what? One would hope that having read that, you would know what was happening.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I know what's going on, but yeah. I'm wondering why you choose to embed this as these as adjectives or modifiers as opposed to taking them into short sentences. Or are you just naturally...
Would I do that?
Wait. Well, you could say he began... Let's look at this.
Yeah. Let's deconstruct.
Okay, so he began that unmistakable wet mouth, lip smacking, compulsive swallowing that indicates the impending need to vomit. You could always said it was reminiscent of a need to vomit, the smacking of lips or something along those lines.
Or his mouth was wet.
His mouth.
Period.
Exactly.
He smacked his lips. Period.
Exactly. If you want to go Hemingway,
he was swallowing. Yeah, he was swallowing. He looked like he was going to vomit. But those don't. That doesn't convey the sort of ominous buildup of being trapped on a subway car near someone who's about to possibly throw up. I guess that's, you know, that's the thing.
It's all about momentum then for you.
In that particular case, I suppose so.
Well, in terms of general cases, if we're going to talk about general use of modifiers, do you feel that this kind of flow leads you to this buildup that you're describing here for the most part in terms of, you know, it seems to me that it's largely intuitive based off of what you're saying.
I mean, that's the thing. I have no real control over it. And to be perfectly, you know, narcissistic double standard about it, I often find it annoying when other people use too many adjectives and things get too flowery. So I don't know. Perhaps I'm giving myself more credit than I deserve. It's just the way I write and talk. I mean, this is what's rather disturbing and distressing is that I have almost no control over the way I speak and write. And I've said this before too. It's all I can do to stay conscious during the act, let alone sort of bring in formal considerations. Although that clearly can't be true either. I mean, there must be formal considerations, but I don't. And if I were to truly think about them, yes, I think that there is that kind of, I do like that sense of momentum. I do like the building of a head of steam. And truthfully, it also must act as a sort of intellectual bellows, you know, blowing oxygen onto some sort of gathering flame.
Mm-hmm.
It must be the way, the sort of overlaying of adjective upon adjective must be the way that I arrive at things.
For these early essays in Fraud, did you read these aloud to know that the rhythm was right, or did you just essentially look at them on the page? And I mean, some were designed for oral and some were designed for visual. And I'm wondering if you apply a particular rhythmic standard for these early pieces. I mean, now it seems that with the second book, it's more consciously designed for the text.
Yeah, I mean, whatever ended up in the first book, even if it began orally, was fairly significantly rewritten and lengthened for the text version thereof. So there was no. My primary allegiance is to written text, and whatever oral stuff happens when I and if it hasn't come, you know, if I haven't had the folks on the radio editing it, when I go out and do a reading, you know, my editions of my two books from which I read are incredibly marked up, and vast sections are deleted, pages are simply dog-eared so that I'll pass over them. You know, it's essentially the teacher's edition. It's very different, and it's significantly shorter what I will read to a crowd out loud. But no, if I'm thinking about what I'm writing for the page, and the thought that anyone might actually read it on the page, I'm not concerned with myself or a reader running out of breath. You know, my hope is that it's being read silently or in, what's that thing that Steven Pinker calls it, mentalese.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just, no, I don't think anyone's gonna forget it. And the hope is that also there's enough of a voice or a flavor that within a page or two, you can sort of understand the rhythms. That I think is a pretty quick learning curve. I don't think that my stuff is inaccessible or difficult to read. But the rhythms, I think, assert themselves fairly quickly, and you can sort of jaunt along for the ride pretty easily. You know, it's like, oh, okay, once this movie reference is over, we'll go back to the story. But my primary allegiance is to the page.
Well, how does this affect, say, the audiobook version?
Audiobook version is an exhausting thing to do. It takes, what does it take? It takes about 3 days, and it's just, it's very tiring work. It's rough on the throat. It's rough on the diaphragm. You know, there's a good deal of breath control. I mean, just simply reading that much stuff for that long a time. It seems to me, and I know that there are audiobooks where great concessions have been made to add music and other voices and such. That's not what I go to recorded readings for. Recorded readings for me are, I like being read to. I like the text. I like hearing it. It's a different thing. It's not a radio play. It's not a radio drama, which I love too, but that's not what I want an audiobook to be. I would try and write a radio play if I wanted to do that. So it's tremendously difficult work, but the hope is that it's simply the book aloud, which is different from it as a radio piece. Yeah, it's sort of a third sex, yet another creature entirely.
So I'm wondering how many different versions of one individual piece there actually are. I mean, there must be many.
There's probably the radio version, the text version. I mean, if it began on the radio.
Yeah.
So there's the radio version, the text version, the publicly performed version where I don't have benefit of music or cuts or things like that. And then the audiobook version, which is just the text version made plain. For example, when we did the audiobooks, rather than abridging pieces, I excised entire pieces. You know, I thought that would be preferable to just simply not have some pieces that I didn't think were that strong and certainly didn't lend themselves to making someone listen to them. I can't remember what they were now, you know, because these are already a few years back. But yeah, it's my feeling about an audiobook specifically is that it's not a public performance and it's not a radio story. Hmm. That it's very much, it's in service to the book.
Gotcha. While we're on this subject of flow, I actually wanted to ask you about a half alliteration thing you do, where, just to give you an example, like in Lush Life, there's a quorum of spores. you have this tendency to emphasize certain sounds like this, but it's never complete rhyme and it's never complete alliteration. So I wanted to ask you, are you aware of this?
Oh, that I'm aware of. Yes, I like I like stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like things that are euphonious in that way. It's sort of an eighth of a pun, I guess.
Yeah. So I guess you could call it that, but it's enough of a cockeyed thing to have a flow, but not have a flow at the same time.
Yeah,
which it throws you off just a little bit.
Oh, that's nice. I would hope it's like biting into a cumin seed or something like that. That you would, that you would kind of be like, hey, I just tasted something kind of thing. You know, it's that is the hope.
How did that come about, or was this something? When did you observe this? When were you aware of that you were doing this?
I don't know. I mean, I think that this isn't obviously, but I do remember being in fourth grade, or grade four, as we called it in Canada, which was in 1974. And in our reader were the lyrics to Eleanor Rigby. And our teacher, I think it was Mrs. Spindle, pointed out that the vowel sounds were such that I can't even remember what the vowel sounds were or what part of the song they're written as a poem, she was pointing out, but that there was some sort of consciousness. And I remember thinking, really, they thought of that? Mm-hmm. That's amazing. That's really, that's impressive. And I guess I never sort of forgot that. If you're going to choose a word, and if you have the choice of word, you have many tools at your disposal for what that word might do, both in terms of meaning and in terms of sound. And
but it could also very well be intuitive. I mean, there's the famous story of them writing 8 days a week in 10 minutes on the back of a matchbox.
Sure. And so I don't think of it in that way. It's probably more echolalic. Is that even a word? I don't know.
Like
echolaliac.
Coin as many new adjectives. It must be, we're on modifiers exactly. Here, so go for it,
It must be sort of more of a kind of a borderline psychotic kind of take all my medications and stand outside the Honduran embassy in my underpants kind of like, hey, this rhymes and that rhymes, and I'm going to use this particular consonant vowel combination. But so it's both conscious and unconscious, but it is something that gives me sort of pleasure.
In light of the fact that it could be unconscious, do you need to have a sort of unconscious realm or a place, you were sort of intimating this earlier, a place where you can sort of go to which will defy your expectations so that you'll come out of it with a completely different essay or different piece than you possibly expected from entering?
Do you mean a place where I go to a tangent I write about, or
I'm thinking more of a conceptual construct. Like, for example, when you go and write an essay about the log cabin Republicans,
yes,
you're obviously bringing certain prejudgments to the table. But yes. What steps do you take to invert those prejudgments, or attempt to subvert them, or sort of come out of this with a totally different sense of where you came in?
Oh, there's the only preparatory thing that I do, because one goes into every story with a hypothesis and with a judgment. You can't help that. If you're over 4 years old, you've had some experience and everything comes saddled with associations and thoughts. But insofar as I'm not 4 years old, nor in fact am I 23, thank God, It's a conscious and constant effort. If I've taken on a story, to go into it very hip to my judgments and my preconceptions and trying to turn them off, trying to simply observe things, asking questions and all that, but as far as I can possibly manage to not Heisenberg the data by framing questions like, where do you get off, or how can you think, one has to try and keep that all tamped down, because otherwise you're going to queer the data.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not going to get a story. And that said, if you talk to anybody or observe anything for longer than 48 hours, you're going to find something that is surprising to you. As I was reading this little essay in the back of the Times magazine, like 2 weeks ago or last week, which basically had this very good thing that said, it's easy to hate something or someone in concept, in theory, but in practice, it's almost impossible. You know, everybody's got a story. Everybody's got a reason. Everybody's got an alibi. Everybody's got an excuse. And everybody's got their reasons, you know. And so it really is just the barest kind of journalistic practice. I mean, because, you know, I'm not Edward R. Murrow, you know, I'm just a guy. And, but I do find that almost invariably, if I cover a story, it will take me somewhere somewhat surprising. There are exceptions. Sometimes I'm not surprised, and sometimes...
Well, even in the Austrian teacher's piece, you openly confess that I am both the best journalist for the job and the worst kind of journalist for a job, in the sense that you actually want to help these various people. But I must turn the question around to you. Are you a journalist? Are you a quasi-journalist? Or?
At this point, I'm a specific kind of journalist. Would I put me on the staff at a daily newspaper? Perhaps not immediately, but if I were forced to be on the staff of a daily newspaper, I would learn. I could learn. You know, it's not... it's my great good privilege that I'm... You know, I'm the luckiest guy in North America. I am given a forum and an opportunity to really put in my two cents on whatever. If someone is asking me to do something, it's specifically because they want my take on it, which is a really privileged place to be as a writer. I did years and years of writing for money where my take was not the purpose of the exercise. And I bridled against it, and I did it anyway. I needed to make a living, and, you know, it was a good training. So am I a journalist? I'm a very specific kind of journalist in that way.
My fantasies, my reveries, are hiding deep within. You worthless fraud, you ugly cheat, I trusted you, look at me now. My days are grim, my nights light up with useless memories. Your features so bitter.